session.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, Ron Elving on the Week in Politics. Then concerns of Afghans waiting on asylum applications. Dennis Leary on a star-filled new holiday film about the overlooked heroines of the season. And a man at Minuteman National Historical Park in Massachusetts who says,
I greet tourists from around the world in their native tongue with their favorite song, prayer, or poem in 46 languages. Pick a country, I'll sing you the song.
Yeah, how about the national anthem of San Marino? But BJ Lederman still does our theme music. First, we have our newscast. It's Saturday, November 29, 2025.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with a special edition of the Up North Report.
Everybody get their own baseline. Get manganese tested on your water.
Tracy, if I can, this is a point I should jump in.
People in the audience of an overflowing Emily City Council chambers last week occasionally interjected and applauded as members heard an update on a potential manganese mining operation. Councilmember Dan Brennan was the one who jumped in at this moment, directing questions to North Star Manganese CEO Rick Sandry. Sandry was at the meeting to share the latest updates on a project that's been on the table for at least 17 years. A third-party study of a possible mine, known as a preliminary economic assessment, shows that not only is it financially viable, but it could make back its investment in less than 2 years. There's a whole heap of steps that the company needs to undertake now. Sandry likened the report to them having graduated kindergarten. There's pre-feasibility reports and feasibility reports and environmental testing, not to mention a likely many years-long permitting process before a mine could open. But what the people of Emily want to know is, when are they going to test the drinking water? And is that water in danger of contamination if an underground mine were to be built? Brennan joined the council in 2024, but he's long been a part of the Emily Mine Information Group, a citizen organization conducting its own research. He says the group took on testing on its own when it became clear that promises weren't being kept by those involved in the exploration before North Star Manganese.
It seems to me that more can be being done to assess the impacts here as well as for you and your bottom line.
Well, that's where the next phase of our activity is to do that. Had we come up with a bad answer on a PEA, we would be telling everybody thank you very much for allowing us to participate up here, pick up our shoes and go somewhere else to look for another project.
Some of the first exploratory drilling in Emily occurred decades ago in the late 1940s and early 1950s. Various drilling efforts by different mining companies, including in 2023 by North Star, gave insight into what was locked deep below the earth, billions of pounds of rich manganese ore. An accelerated push toward clean energy alternatives and a growing market for electric vehicles and other battery-powered technologies reignited interest in the site's potential. Manganese is one of the metals used in battery production, combined with nickel and cobalt to increase energy storage capacity. While the element is one of the most plentiful on the planet, a small sliver appears to be pure enough for battery use, and signs so far point to Emily's deposit containing that high-quality ore. If the mine moves forward, it would be the only such operation on the continent in a marketplace where most of the mining is happening in Africa and processing in China. The report predicts the mine lifespan would be at least 23 years, producing 400,000 tons of manganese annually. Mayor Tracy Jones asked Sandry to explain in the simplest terms possible what the benefits would be for Emily residents.
You know, 25 years of activity here that people will be buying from the ACE, going to the, you know, local restaurants and things of that sort. So that kind of base.
He also pointed to cash payments per ton of material, a plethora of taxes levied by the state that benefit the local governments, and about 100 high-paying mining jobs. 30-year councilmember Gary Hansen, who described himself as among the skeptics, responded.
But Rick, you got to keep in mind, no amount of money replaces what we have here.
This is, and I fully support that.
Sandry said he views this project as his parting legacy in a long career, and it's important to him to get it right.
I'm an environmentalist that's in the mining industry. I believe that things need to be done correctly to be able to utilize the assets that God gave us on this planet. But I believe we should utilize the assets. So I come from that side of the use. And I don't want it to be my reputation or on my tombstone that I caused issues at Emily.
There's more to this story. Find photos and diagrams and more at KAXE.org. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. The Wednesday shooting of two West Virginia National Guard members could result in major immigration policy changes. 20-year-old Sarah Beckstrom has died. 24-year-old Andrew Wolf is in critical condition. The suspect in custody is an Afghan national who entered the U.S. through Operation Allies Welcome. In 2021, his application for asylum was approved under the Trump administration. President Trump has called for several measures, like a permanent pause on migration from, quote, all third world countries and denaturalizing those who, quote, undermine domestic tranquility. NPR's Ron Elving joins us. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
Those would be sweeping changes. Can the president really do that?
The president can say what he wants to say. He can make everyone respond to whatever he's proposing. He can steer the conversation and, to some degree, control the agenda. He can also issue, as we know, his executive orders and make elements of the executive branch do things. But the scale of these threats and the use of terms such as permanent pause or third world countries or disturbing domestic tranquility, let's just say there would be a lot to work out in the enforcement. And that's assuming any such effort survived in federal courts. Now, Trump did attempt something like this with his so-called Muslim ban early in his first term. That caused great confusion and disruption in court resistance until finally a third revision got the blessing of the Supreme Court on a 5-4 vote.
How popular are President Trump's immigration policies with Americans right now?
They have been popular. Immigration has been his best issue with voters this year, but his approval numbers on immigration have fallen lately, along with his polls in general. There's been less attention paid to the southern border in the media, and lots of negative notice given to ICE raids and deportations. Now, this tragic National Guard story could turn things around again. Like in 2015, you may remember it was exactly 10 years ago this time of year that Trump, then just a candidate for the Republican nomination, proposed a ban on all Muslims entering the U.S. That, too, was in response to a shocking gun crime that was attributed to immigrants. And lo and behold, that posting on Twitter boosted Trump back to the lead in major polls of Republicans who were seeking the White House in that cycle. It's possible Trump has not forgotten how all that played out for him back then.
Another critical question of the week. What is the status of that 28-point plan the U.S. presented to Ukraine with a Thanksgiving deadline?
The plan was close to a set of proposals from a Russian diplomat named Dmitriev. What that plan gave Russia was parts of eastern Ukraine that the Russian army has occupied, but also other parts that they have not. Now, that's a big deal. It's largely what the war has been about. So Ukraine has parried that thrust for now, and the question is whether the Russians can live with something less. Putin made it clear on Friday that he expects to gain a lot of territory in this deal, and he scoffed at suggestions that Trump's negotiator Steve Witkoff had been coaching the Russians or helping them deal with Trump. And, of course, not helping this process is that Andrei Yermak, a top negotiator and one of the most powerful men in Ukraine, resigned yesterday in the wake of a major corruption scandal.
Ron, what are you watching for in Congress between now and the holidays?
The biggest thing right now is health care. What to do about expiring subsidies for health insurance under Obamacare that are going to cause enormous spikes in what people have to pay and cost some people their insurance. That was the issue in the shutdown this fall, and it has not been resolved. Last week, Trump said those subsidies might just have to be extended for a time, maybe just long enough to get past the 2026 midterm elections. That would be politically expedient, but many House Republicans are digging in their heels, do not want to be seen as bailing out Obamacare, even if temporarily. And without a resolution on this issue, we may well be right back in government shutdown early next year.
Ron Elvin, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Thousands of Afghans waiting for asylum say they are now in limbo. The Trump administration has stopped issuing visas to those traveling in Afghan passports and paused all asylum decisions in reaction to this week's killing of a National Guard soldier and the wounding of another by an Afghan national. NPR's Dia Hadid has been speaking to some waiting for asylum and joins us now from Mumbai. Dia, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome, Scott.
What have these Afghans been saying to you?
They've been telling me how distressed they are. These are really dark days for the some 265,000 Afghans who advocates say were in the pipeline to come to the US. Like Roshangar, he was in the Afghan military. He used to sign off on airstrikes targeting Taliban fighters. He's now in hiding in Afghanistan in fear of his life, which is why I won't use his full name. But Roshangar told me, Scott, that he was ashamed of the Afghan national behind the Wednesday attack in DC. And he added this.
That's very frustrating for us because that was that person's responsibility and act. That was not an act from the whole Afghan community.
And that sense was also echoed by Najib Pekin. He's 45 and used to be a journalist, and he's now living and hiding in Turkey. He spoke in Dari to producer Fediba Akbedi. And what he's saying there is, what's the difference between a man who punishes every countryman for the crime of one person and the Taliban who imprison a family for the crimes of one son?
Dia, what can you tell us about Afghans who were in the process to come to the United States?
Right. Well, most of these people worked and fought alongside U.S. forces or America's allies in Afghanistan, like Roshangar, or they were outspoken critics of the Taliban. But Scott, this isn't the first time the Trump administration has tried to limit the admission of Afghan nationals. And for folks like Roshangar, that means his life has become more and more perilous. And I noticed that because as he was chatting with me, he was stuttering. And then he told me why.
I have a teeth problem. I can't go to dentist. My son is out of school for 4 years. We are living in uncertainty under the Taliban repressive regime.
Such uncertainty. Another woman, Soraya, who was also in the pipeline to come. When I first got to know her, she was living in Pakistan, getting ready to go to the US. But in June, she and her daughters were deported, and now they live under the Taliban too, where women are banned from most jobs, and her daughters aren't allowed to study beyond grade six. She's also in hiding, which is why I'm not using her full name. And she's one of the hundreds of thousands of Afghans that Pakistan has forcibly deported this year, including people who were meant to go to the United States.
The Trump administration says Afghans who entered the U.S. weren't properly vetted. What have you learned by talking to Afghan nationals?
Well, they say they don't know what the Americans were doing behind the scenes, but someone like Roshangar said his application was in process for 3 years before Trump suspended it. He'd done three interviews and was scheduled to do a fourth, and he described them to me like this.
So they are asking about my background about my family members, about my wife, my wife's family, my job, my first job, and my second job, my email addresses, my address of livings.
It was so extensive, and he had to provide that information going back a decade. One prominent advocate, Sean Vandiver from Afghan Evac, says these migrants are extensively and exhaustively vetted. He says any gaps in the system should be fixed, but says one Afghan shooters really don't reflect the vast majority of Afghan migrants who are meant to come to the United States.
Dear Hadid, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Scott.
The holiday music season has begun in stores, on radio stations, and on speakers in our living room. And I've come back to a holiday favorite, Fairy Tale of New York by the Pogues. It's not exactly chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
It was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank, an old man said to me, won't see another one.
It's set in a time of black and white movies and Sinatra songs, with a man who's an Irish immigrant sleeping off a holiday bender in a New York City jail. On that cold floor, he dreams of the woman who has shared his dreams of life in America.
They got cars big as bars, they got rivers of gold, but the wind goes right through you, it's no place for the old. When you first took my hand on a cold Christmas Eve,
Christy McCall and Shane McGowan are the couple who soon hurl curses and slurs at each other's hearts about how they quashed their dreams. Some other performers' versions over the years have reworded some of the more pungent insults with the band's assent so the song can be more widely played. And Fairy Tale of New York has become a kind of holiday standard. It gives voice, raspy then sweet, to those who may feel anxious, lost, lonely, or just left out of all the merry songs about good tidings, herald angels singing, and ho-ho-hos. Yet even as the couple snap and snarl, they realize how they have changed with each other and go on together. "You took my dreams," she says. He answers, "I put them with my own." Nearly 40 years on, the Pogues' Fairy Tale can remind us how sailing on a sea of troubles can cause us to hold each other closer.
I could have been someone.
Well, so could anyone. You took my dreams from me when I first found you.
I kept them with me, babe. I put them with my own. Can't make it all alone. I built my dreams around you.
The boys of the NYPD chorus to sing "Go Away, Babe," and the
bells are ringing out.
And you're listening to NPR News.
You should give as you are able, because the need is immediate.
Longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media.
It's the people here who make it go. If you want a nice, independent, completely northern Minnesota media source that isn't beholden to anybody else, you have to be willing to put in a little bit of money. This is the time, this is the moment when we have to make decisions about what really is important to our community and to ourselves.
I'm Jennifer Barr. Give right now at KAXC.org. Thank you for your support. Minutes after 7 o'clock. Thank you so much for listening to Weekend Edition on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. 9 o'clock this morning, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg, a mix of story and song. And at 10 o'clock, Corey Campbell, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. The Bemidji Senior Center invites you to a Christmas concert with the First City Singers on Monday, 4 o'clock. And if you or someone you know is living with Parkinson's disease, there is a support group on Tuesday, December 2nd, 1 p.m. in the meeting room at Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids. The group meets the first Tuesday of every month. Fire in the Village hosts the Creative Crow Club the first Wednesday of each month from 4 to 6 at Old Central School in Grand Rapids. Youth can explore their artistic gifts, find their voice, and build a caring community. You can find a list of next week's events at KAXE.org. Look for events up north. More news is next on KAXE.
And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. At least 128 people are dead after a massive fire tore through a high-rise housing complex in Hong Kong. More than 100 people are still missing, and officials warn more bodies may be found as recovery workers do a thorough search of the buildings. Reporter Charisse Pham joins us from Hong Kong. Charisse, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
This is just a devastating story, of course. What can you tell us about what's happening today?
Today, this city is in mourning. Rescue efforts officially ended yesterday, an acknowledgement that it's unlikely that any more survivors will be found. Government officials held a moment of silence this morning. Official events and celebrations have been canceled, and flags across the city are flying at half mast this weekend.
This was just an enormous fire. Can you help us understand how many people have been affected in addition to those who were killed?
Yeah, that's right. The fire broke out in a big public housing complex called Wong Fuk Court. It's in a northeast suburb of Hong Kong, Tai Po. The complex is home to about 4,600 people living across eight buildings, each more than 30 stories high. The fire tore through all but one of those buildings. And many of the survivors are elderly. Some of the people I talked to earlier this week had lived there since it was built in the early 1980s. Two of the hardest hit buildings were burned so badly, they're just charred black. So we're looking at likely thousands of survivors who are now effectively homeless.
I gather officials are talking more about how and why the fire spread so quickly. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the housing complex had been under renovation. Then the buildings were covered in bamboo scaffolding and protective mesh netting. And at first, officials suspected that the netting was not up to standard. But now they say it did meet fire resistance standards. So the focus now are on these styrofoam boards that were used to protect the building's windows during renovation. The fire department said they tested those boards and found that they were highly flammable. They say as the boards caught fire, the high temperatures caused the windows to shatter, and this allowed the fire to move into the buildings and apartments. So you can imagine the fires moving up through the styrofoam boards and into the buildings through the shattered windows, and officials say that's how it spread so quickly. The fire broke out on Wednesday afternoon. Within hours, it was labeled a level 5 alarm fire, the city's highest, and it burned for nearly 2 days. It wasn't fully extinguished until Friday morning. And the fire department chief said that the fire alarms were also not working properly.
Charisse, what is ahead next for survivors and for Hong Kong?
Well, for now, officials are turning their focus to the people involved in the renovation of this housing complex. Police arrested three people from a construction company on suspicion of manslaughter on Thursday, and a corruption probe has led to the arrest of eight other people involved in the renovations on Friday. And of course, like you said, the attention is on helping people affected by the fire. I've seen the heart of this city out in full force these last days. A lot of people just want to help in any way that they can. One local physiotherapist, Angela Lung, had been going to the temporary shelter set up by the government She was offering acupuncture and cupping to survivors and handing out pain patches and Tiger Balm. Tiger Balm is this ointment for pain relief that's widely used here in Hong Kong. And because a lot of the older folks are just finding it hard to sleep on mattresses on the shelter's floors because they have knee and joint pain. We also have, of course, the Hong Kong Red Cross and other emergency relief organizations providing basics like pillows and phone chargers and soap and diapers, because many of these survivors, Scott, have lost everything.
Reporter Charisse Pham in Hong Kong, thank you so much.
Thank you.
An order of Catholic nuns in Wisconsin recently returned land they had purchased in 1966 to the indigenous tribe that originally settled it. During a ceremony with deep spiritual symbolism, the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration turned over land to the Luc de Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. It is believed to be the first such land transfer by a Catholic institution in the U.S. in the name of reparations for past treatment of Native Americans. Robin Washington of Wisconsin Public Radio reports on what both sides call a historic act of healing.
The greeting in the Ojibwe language is to a gathering outside a Catholic spirituality center in a wooded area next to one of many small lakes in the northern Wisconsin town of Arbor Vitae.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Tribal President John Johnson, Sr. from Lac de Flambeau. It's a very good day here today for all of us. And,
for decades, like the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration used this Marywood property as a retreat center. On October 31st, the sisters formally transferred it to the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. Though it's now worth millions, they gave it back for the same $30,000 they themselves paid when they purchased it in 1966.
We hope that this transfer of what we called Marywood to the Lac de Flambeau is a sign of hope and light, that being vulnerable, dialoguing with each other, can bring about what may seem impossible.
Sister Sue Ernster is president of the order. She says the land transfer is a form of reparations for the legacy of Catholic boarding schools that Native American children were forced to attend for decades. The sisters say returning this property, which was not itself a school, is a way to acknowledge a painful past.
We knew the next caretakers needed to be those who honored and held sacred the land and all of creation as we do.
The transfer goes well beyond land acknowledgments, which have become commonplace nationwide, but are often criticized as empty gestures. Araya Breedlove is the public relations director for the tribe.
This is acknowledgement put into action, and I think that is the biggest difference compared to what we've been seeing nationwide.
The tribe and the sisters say their action last month is unprecedented. In 2017, the Jesuit order returned 500 unused acres in South Dakota to the Rosebud Sioux tribe. But experts say the Franciscan sisters' return of their land is different.
This is definitely the first land transfer from an order of Catholic sisters to an indigenous tribe. It is the first land transfer from any Catholic institution to a Native nation in the name of healing and reparations.
That's Brittany Catellis of Land Justice Futures, a group that advises Catholic orders and helped guide this action. Back at the shores of the lake, it was time to make the transfer official.
All right, at this time, we are going to be signing the official documents.
As the signatures made the transfer official, both parties marked the transaction in their spiritual traditions.
The return of this land is far more than a symbolic act. It is a living acknowledgement of our sovereignty and to the sacred relationship that connects our people to these ancestral territories.
The Lac du Flambeau tribe plans on using the facility for professional housing, spiritual events, healing, education, and intertribal meetings. For NPR News, I'm Robin Washington in Superior, Wisconsin.
And the story was produced in collaboration with Wisconsin Public Television and the news outlet Indian Country Today. Ragtime, the 1998 musical based on E.L. Doctorow's 1975 novel, mixes historical characters with fictitious ones at the turn of the 20th century. It's now getting a revival at New York's Lincoln Center with its mixture of Jewish immigrants, black residents of Harlem, and privileged white characters. The show appeals strongly to current audiences, as Jeff London reports.
And there was distant music, simple and somehow sublime, giving the nation a new syncopation, the people called it ragtime.
This piece is resonating just as much as ever, and not a word has changed since it was written.
Casey Levy plays Mother, a kind of proto-feminist whose comfortable upper-class white existence in the suburbs of New York City undergoes upheaval over the course of the show.
You know, there's joy in that and there's sadness in that too, but what a time to be able to do it.
The show looks at the American dream and its underbelly. It's been staged during different administrations. When Ragtime premiered on Broadway in 1998, Bill Clinton was president. When it was revived in 2009, Barack Obama was president. And now, with this Broadway revival, Donald Trump occupies the Oval Office. Actor Joshua Henry plays Colehouse Walker, a black musician with dreams.
Sarah, it must be true. The country that lets a man like me own a car, raise a child, build a life with you.
But over the course of the show, his dreams get crushed by racism, and he becomes radicalized.
This is one of those pieces that never ceases to be relevant. And to be able to be in this piece right now feels like, oh, this is my portion. This is how I'm going to serve in this moment.
It's so fascinating to me to know that we wrote something, you know, with very open hearts and no political agenda. We just wanted to tell this amazing story. And look what has happened.
Lyricist Lynn Aaron's grandparents fled from oppression in Eastern Europe to opportunity in America, just like some of the characters in Ragtime.
It is mirroring this very awful, divisive, frightening time where all of the same problems for immigrants and for women and for, you know, black people, everybody feels attacked and frightened.
In fact, this production of Ragtime is based on a concert version done in October and November of 2024. Director Lear de Bessonnet says the night after the election,
it was a space that contained more emotion from the audience than anything I've ever felt in the theater. And it wasn't a monochromatic emotion, right? People were feeling many different things.
Go out and tell our story. Let it echo far and wide. Make them hear you. Make them hear you.
And they were connecting deeply with the show and with each other. And it was an opportunity to share humanity and to share questions about who we are right now as a people.
It's really powerful at Lincoln Center as well.
Composer Stephen Flaherty.
You know, you can literally hear gasps from the audience, because it has to do with the timing, I think.
Even though the show is epic, part of what allows audiences to hear the words anew is that the production itself is spare. Without a lot of scenery, the focus falls squarely on Terrence McNally's words and the lyrics, says songwriter Lynn Ahrens.
Terrence's book is so fabulous, you know, and the lines in it they just keep hitting me personally, you know, in the heart, you know, like guns were going off everywhere. And we can never go back to before, which is a song that grew out of one line that Terrence wrote.
Where are they now, those women who stared from the mirror? We can never go back to before.
As a 10-year-old child actor in 1996, Brandon Uranowitz was in the tryout of Ragtime in Toronto. Now he plays Tate, the Jewish immigrant father who, after many trials, reinvents himself in America.
The entire piece is about people aspiring to something bigger than themselves, dreaming of a promise that has abstractly existed for them, but that may be out of reach. And I think the tragedy of the piece is that some folks don't get to achieve that, and then the hope of the piece is that some folks do.
While Ragtime was only set to run at Lincoln Center in January, it's been extended to the end of June. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
The skies were blue and hazy, barely a storm, barely a chill.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. So when's the last time you placed a call over a landline? Cell phones and the internet have mostly replaced corded phones across the country, but for those who live in remote areas, landlines can be a sure way to reach emergency services. Kathy Yerger lives in the small community of Hacienda, California. She spoke to us on a landline, her landline, about why it's still important to her.
If we need to call 911 for an ambulance or a fire, which California's had plenty of fires, that's the only reliable source we have to communicate outside of our neighborhood.
Stella Yu has been reporting on this story for Cal Matters. She joins us now from Sacramento. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Are landlines at risk of disappearing?
So there are about 500,000 people in the state of California that rely on AT&T's copper landlines. Many of these landlines are what AT&T is required by law to provide. AT&T has an obligation by law to be the carrier of last resort in California, but the company is planning to retire its copper network nationwide. And part of their argument is maintaining copper is very expensive. It costs the company $1 billion a year just in California to maintain those copper lines. And if they can free up some of that money, they say they can start providing some more advanced technology like fiber. So the worry from many communities in California is how exactly that will affect their own neighborhoods. When I asked AT&T, the company said it won't pull out from all the areas in California, just the ones where people already have other options like broadband and cell phone, or areas where nobody lives. But to this day, we don't really know which areas will be affected exactly, or how reliable those alternatives can be.
What did people who have landlines tell you about why they still rely on them?
Many of these people who still use landlines are in rural areas, like where Kathy lives, where internet and cell services are unreliable and in some cases not even available. That is an issue in suburban areas as well. We're hearing from readers that some neighborhoods in the greater LA area also rely on landlines because sometimes they just don't have reliable alternatives. In the LA fire earlier this year, a lot of cell towers became obsolete really quickly. Other alternatives like the voice over internet protocol phones, which are often called another type of landlines, they also have to rely on power and internet to function. And you can imagine when electricity is out, a lot of those options quickly become unavailable.
Mm. Is there a Save the Landlines movement?
That depends on who you ask. I think in the rural Northern California town that I went to, they are very aware of this problem. And AT&T has been fighting this fight in California for 2 years. It's not a new issue that just came on this year. It has tried and spent big to try to sway lawmakers and regulators to give it this relief. But we're seeing hundreds of comments from the public who are really worried that their landlines might be taken away. Those public members are also trying to lobby lawmakers and regulators to help them keep AT&T here.
Stella Yu, who is a politics reporter for Cal Matters, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 7:39. You're listening to KAXE and Weekend Edition. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg, a mix of story and song. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, Native Lights podcast, and then at 1:30, our new Season Watch pod with hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, and John Latimer, rotating cast of characters as well. New episodes of the Season Watch podcast come out on Thursdays, and you can find that where you get your podcasts. Or, as I mentioned, it is on the air today at 1:30 or tomorrow morning at 10:30. The Bagley Community Theater presents A Christmas Carol December 4th through the 6th at 7 p.m. plus Sunday, December 7th, 2 o'clock at Bagley High School Auditorium. Tickets available at Ace Hardware in Bagley or at the door. And the Iron Range Area Council of Minnesota Chippewa Tribes has their annual Christmas party this Thursday, 6 o'clock at Marble City Hall. Enjoy a potluck dinner and native bingo.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. In Hong Kong, the death toll is at least 128 after firefighters located dozens more bodies in a massive apartment complex fire. Authorities say fire alarms did not sound in the structure. The blaze is now out. Parisian authorities believe they now have in custody the four people who executed the broad daylight robbery of crown jewels from the Louvre last month. The last of the four was apprehended a few days ago. The holiday shopping season is ramping up, with Thanksgiving Day proving to be an early purchasing leader. Adobe Analytics reports people spent $6.4 billion online Thursday, 5% more than last year. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Subaru. The Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. And from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The Atlantic hurricane season, which draws to an official close this month, fulfilled forecasts that it would be an active one. There were 13 named storms, three Category 5 hurricanes. That includes Melissa, which last month brought devastation and dozens of deaths to Jamaica. Accurately forecasting storms has always been a challenge for scientists. NPR's Greg Allen has this report on how a new hurricane model powered by AI is helping predict storm path and strength with greater accuracy.
Melissa was not only the season's most destructive hurricane, it was one of the most intense Atlantic hurricanes ever. As it neared landfall in Jamaica with 185-mile-per-hour winds, National Hurricane Center Director Mike Brennan had a dire warning for island residents.
Take cover now. Catastrophic winds with total structural failure likely near the path. The eye wall moves across portions of western Jamaica.
Melissa devastated communities like Black River and St. Elizabeth. But a week before the hurricane made landfall, forecast models disagreed on what path it might take. One model that got it right, accurately predicting Melissa's path and its Category 5 intensity, was a new one introduced this year. It's Google's DeepMind AI-based hurricane model. James Franklin, a former branch chief at the National Hurricane Center, analyzed how hurricane forecast models performed this year, including Google's.
The model performed very, very well, which was very impressive. It was the best guidance that we saw this year.
Artificial intelligence has been used in weather forecast models for some time. Google's DeepMind, though, marks a significant step forward, one that suggests AI may soon overtake the physics-based models meteorologists have long relied on. Models like the Global Forecast System, the GFS, developed by NOAA, are based on equations that calculate how wind, moisture, and heat move around in the atmosphere. The models use those equations to predict what's going to happen in the atmosphere, including the track and intensity of hurricanes. AI models like Google's DeepMind, Franklin says, on the other hand, don't know anything about physics, but focus instead on history.
They have been developed to go back and look at historical records and tease out patterns and relationships about what has happened in the past in very subtle ways that, you know, a person could not extract on their own.
In developing their hurricane model, engineers at Google worked closely with scientists at the National Hurricane Center and Colorado State University. Kate Musgrave, a research scientist at the university, analyzes the performance of AI-based models, including Google's. She says past AI models did well with one part of a hurricane forecast, tracking the path of a storm.
Because that is governed by large-scale influences in the atmosphere. Intensity, however, how strong a storm is going to be, is not captured well in the AI models.
The Google model, however, did very well in forecasting intensity, she says, because it added historical data detailing how past hurricanes developed. Musgrave believes AI modeling may be the future, not just for hurricanes, but also in forecasting other weather phenomena, everything from tornadoes to cold snaps. The National Hurricane Center has embraced the new Google DeepMind model, particularly as it tracked Hurricane Melissa. But for forecasters used to seeing data on wind, pressure, humidity, and sea surface temperature and how it's interpreted by the physics-based models, Franklin says relying on AI can be unsettling.
AI models are something like a black box to a forecaster. A lot of data goes in, you get a forecast that comes out, but you don't really know how it came up with that.
Although AI models will become increasingly important, Franklin and Musgrave don't expect them to replace either long-standing physics-based models or the judgment of experienced forecasters. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Oh, What Fun is a Christmas comedy that's built around an observation that's hard to dispute.
Why does St. Nick get all the credit?
Moms do all the work.
Mom?
Mom?
My girlfriend is a vegan. We're eating sirloin.
Ho, ho, ho. Oh, What Fun stars Michelle Pfeiffer as a mother named Claire Kloster. The all-star cast includes Felicity Jones, Joan Chen, Jason Schwartzman, Chloe Grace Moretz, and, as Claire's lucky husband, Nick, Dennis Leary, who joins us from New York now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Does Claire's family see what's bubbling up inside of her?
No, they're completely, all of us, blind to it. Totally taking her for granted. So, yeah, you can see why she's so so pissed off by the time we forget to put her in the car with us when we go to the holiday Christmas show.
I mean, every family member, there's a bill of particulars, but is Nick, her husband, ungrateful or just oblivious?
Oblivious. You know, he's got an assignment to build this gigantic dollhouse that he of course, you know, waited till the last second to do. And he's paying attention to the scores of his favorite teams. He's oblivious.
I would like to make a toast to a very special person.
Aww.
Somebody that I think is the heart and soul of this operation. And somebody that I think embodies the true spirit of Christmas.
It's Santa Claus!
Like the kids, except it's worse because he lives with her. He's just completely taking her for granted. Taking Michelle Pfeiffer for granted, ladies and gentlemen.
Didn't think it was possible.
It's not possible.
Yeah, of course it isn't. As we learned, how do you play a husband who doesn't seem to deserve the extraordinary woman he's married, and yet the woman sees something in him worth loving?
Well, it's quite a bit like my own life. My wife is, I married above my station, as they say. So
you're married to the well-known novelist, Ann Leary.
Yeah, she's an amazingly talented, funny, smart woman. And so I have some experience with taking a really outstanding woman for granted, or not paying, especially at the holidays, not paying enough attention. What I try to do is keep my, I check in every couple of hours. Anything you need me to do, you know, whatever it is, usually it's moving stuff, lifting stuff, whatever. Go, run to the store, whatever. So I've learned to check in rather than check out. But I have to say, man, the producers are friends of mine. When they called me and said, we have a comedy that's co-written and to be directed by Michael Showalter. Now, first of all, I've been a fan of Michael Showalter's since he was an actor, but I'm a fan of his direction. And then they said, it's a Christmas comedy with Michelle Pfeiffer. And I was like, well, I'm in. And they were like, well, we want you to read the script. And I was like, I'll read the script, but I'm telling you, I'm in. You know, because first of all, I've never worked with Michelle. Second of all, to do a comedy with Michelle, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You'd have to be an idiot not to be excited by the prospect of that. Yeah. Never mind the rest of the cast, which is insane, you know?
You have so many performers playing a family. Does a kind of family feeling develop on set as you're making the film?
Yes, especially when you have really good actors who can dig in to the material and improvise in a real way, not just for laughs, but like within character and within the situation. And all those actors, the kids, as I call them, even though they're all grown adults, from the read-through, everybody kind of clicked. And it takes a couple of weeks. And after a couple of weeks go by, our first week is just the read-throughs and wardrobe and taking some of the Christmas photos. You know, one of the first things we do is dress up and act like a family so we can take photos that are going to be all over the house when we start shooting. The vibe was really good. And then if you have really good actors, within, you know, 2, 3, 4 days of working, all of a sudden it starts to feel like you've known each other for a long time. And you start to improvise together, and that's when it really gels.
You, of course, starred in Rescue Me, a series about firefighters. And helping firefighters and their family has become a real involving personal interest for you, hasn't it?
Yes. I started a foundation called the Leary Firefighters Foundation back in 2000 because my cousin, Jerry Lucy, became a firefighter when we were in our 20s. And from my high school, God, there must have been about 35 guys between my class and my brother's class who became firefighters. So I kind of had firefighters in my life. And when my cousin was killed in the line of duty in 1999, right at Christmas time, with 5 other firefighters, I just decided to help those families and that department, the Worcester Fire Department up in Worcester, Mass. And some of the first guys to come and dig through the rubble in Worcester for the bodies were guys I knew from the FDNY. And 2 years later, almost, you know, the same situation happened in New York. So it's been 25 years now. We've been helping fire departments all over the country. And it's insane because the request for funds and the need for new equipment and training facilities is bigger now than it was when we started. It's crazy. They keep cutting fire department budgets all over the country. So this year, we're literally sending funds to departments in 50 states.
You've got older children now in their 30s, as I do the math. Another theme in the film seems to be parents still want to know that they're needed. I think the line is a tiny little bit. As their children grow up.
Really what it comes down to is, especially for my wife, like you just want them to check in and you're kind of hoping that there's something they're going to ask you to help them out with.
Yep.
You know, I know my daughter did it this week. She called us for some advice and my wife and I couldn't wait to get on speaker and hear what the problem was and offer up our opinions. In the end, They listened to us and completely ignored us and made the opposite decision. But that's fine. We just wanted to have the phone call where they asked for our opinion, yeah, even though they didn't take it.
Well, they still had the benefit of your wisdom, right? Even
exactly. They had the benefit of our wisdom, and they were smart enough not to take it. So it was fine all around.
Dennis Leary is one of the stars, along with Michelle Pfeiffer, of the new film, Oh, What Fun, on Prime Video, starting December 3rd. Thanks so much for being with us, and good holidays to you, sir.
Same to you, sir.
An historic national park in Massachusetts draws tourists from around the world, and no matter how far they've traveled, a local man greets them with a few notes from home in the form of a song. Craig LaMalt of member station GBH met him and has this story.
John Murashanu was diagnosed about 10 years ago with congestive heart failure.
And my cardiologist said, you have to get away from your computer and go for a walk.
So he began a daily ritual of walking in Minuteman National Historical Park. Murashanu was once a history professor, then had a career in finance. He launched outlandishly long-shot bids for U.S. Senate and even president. And he's always loved learning languages. So one day, he decided to introduce himself to one of the park's many international tourists.
And I say, hi, where are you from? And the lady says, France. And I didn't have a plan, but something inside me said, sing to her the Marseillaise, the French national anthem.
So that's what he did.
And I finish, and she says, you made my day.
He says that was a rush.
So I'm hooked, right? I gotta keep doing this.
He started learning songs in other languages, including ones he doesn't speak.
Hello. Hi, where are you from?
Murashanu, who's now 72, introduces himself to John Hu, who's from Chengdu, China.
My favorite Chinese poem is this one. Let me know if you recognize it. Chuan Tian Ming.
Hu grins broadly and pulls out his phone to start recording. He mouths the words as Murashanu looks at the sky, arms outstretched, and sings.
Cool. Nice.
Thank you.
Murashanu walks around this park nearly every day, wearing a fluorescent yellow vest that gives the impression he's there in some kind of official capacity, even though he's not. On this chilly day, he's sporting a hat with fuzzy ear flaps.
Well, I'm like a Walmart greeter. I greet tourists from around the world in their native tongue with their favorite song, prayer, or poem in 46 languages.
Wow.
So if for whatever reason you'd like to hear the most beloved song from any country on the planet, pick a country, I'll sing you the song.
Netherlands.
Lang zal ze leven, lang zal ze leven.
He says his superpower is breaking down cultural barriers. He can sing in Ukrainian, Sanskrit, Swahili, but he doesn't sing at home.
One reason I sing to strangers is my family hates it when I sing, and so this is my outlet.
Even here, it's something of a gamble.
Hello, folks. Where are you all from?
Okay. Thank you, though.
Oops. Well, there we go.
But a lot of people love it.
Very nice.
That's amazing.
And that is what keeps him going.
I believe, actually, that in our DNA, that we are programmed to get our greatest joy from bringing joy to others. I think that's a biological fact. Volare, oh, cantare, oh.
For NPR News, I'm Craig Lamolt in Concord, Massachusetts.
Volare, oh. Cantare, oh, 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 let's fly way up to the clouds.
Ah, oh, Dino. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Of a star that I know of where lovers enjoy peace of mind. Let us leave the confusion.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Storyworth. Each week, Storyworth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, Storyworth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at storyworth.com. And from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation, collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org.
It's just before 8 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You may find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of Weekend Edition, including the Up North Report, local news from our region. 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg, a mix of story and song. And 10 o'clock, Back Porch Harmony with your volunteer host, Corey Campbell. Weather for today, mostly cloudy, highs in the low 20s with calm winds becoming north around 5 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy, lows near 9. And for tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs in the upper teens, winds from the northwest up to 15 miles per hour. Looking ahead to Monday, partly sunny, highs in the mid-teens. Brainerd Community Theater presents Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer December 4th through the 7th at the Chalberg Theater on the campus of Central Lakes College. Find tickets and showtimes at clcperformingarts.com. Thanks for listening to KAXE this morning. There is more ahead from Weekend Edition.